That's the first thing you have to do at any meeting in
we can sit
chamber or something. Provide
all that. How are you? 45.
I grabbed one Friday morning. Is that every Friday morning?
Yes.
I'd like to call the meeting of the committee, Senate Committee on Higher Ed, to order. Today we have with us the Minnesota Private College Council. And I guess our witnesses may have a way that they'd like to handle it, so if you'd just like to introduce yourself, that might be helpful, and then I will let you handle the how you'd like to lay out the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Paul Cirkvenik. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. Here today to testify with me are presidents of three of our colleges, starting from my farthest right, Bob Holst, the president of Concordia University in St. Paul, Jay Barnes, the president of Bethel University in St. Paul or Roseville, and David Anderson, the president of St. Olaf College in Northfield.
Well, welcome to all of you. Thank you for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
What we'd like to do, Madam Chair, is start by giving you an overview of our 17 colleges. I'll go through that, and then I will just turn it over and let each of the three presidents talk for a bit about their colleges, and we'll all be glad to take questions from the committee either while we're in our presentations or when we're done, whichever you prefer.
Well, we will see how the committee, if the committee raises hands or whatever, we'll see what happens. But please proceed however you'd like.
Let me start by saying thank you for the opportunity to testify here today and to give you some background information about our private colleges in Minnesota. We also want to thank you right at the outset for the past support the legislature has shown for the state grant program, which is so important to making college affordable for students with financial need. We recognize that this year you have the worst budget situation probably that the state has ever been through, and we just want to tell you we appreciate your service, especially when you have to serve in such difficult times and under such difficult circumstances. The Minnesota Private College Council is an association of 17 private, nonprofit, four-year colleges and universities. Our schools have a long history in the state of Minnesota. In fact, two of our colleges, Hamline University and St. John's University, were actually founded before the state itself was admitted to the Union. In addition to the 17 locations of our colleges that you can see on this map, our colleges have a number of other locations in different communities where they offer educational programming, sometimes tied to their graduate school offerings. There are, in fact, at least 19 other communities in the state where our schools are offering educational programs. Those communities include Rochester, St. Louis Park, Oakdale, Brainerd, and Bloomington, just to give you some examples. Today, our schools serve about 60,000 students. About 45,000 of those are undergraduates, and about 15,000 are students studying in graduate-level programs. Graduate programs are offered by 11 of our 17 members. As you can see in the chart here, overall, the private colleges educate roughly the same share of Minnesota undergraduates as do the University of Minnesota and the MinSCU four-year state universities. The Private College Council schools produce about 30% of the bachelor's degrees granted annually in the state. Significantly, our schools produce a larger share of degrees in some of the fields most critical to the state's future economic success. And you can see some of those fields are listed on the slide, including 50% of the degrees in the physical sciences. That includes physics and chemistry, 46% in math and statistics, 40% in health professions, and so on. The Private College Council schools produce about 45% of the master's degrees granted in the state of Minnesota each year. Top disciplines for master's degrees from our schools include education, health, business, and public administration. Our schools have a student focus to their work. They're committed to providing meaningful and regular interaction between students and faculty. 58% of the classes at our colleges have fewer than 20 students. That's possible because our schools keep the ratio of students to faculty low, on average about 12 to 1. The focus on our students translates into solid outcomes. The average four-year graduation rate for full-time, first-time students at our colleges is 64%. Our graduation rates are not only the highest in Minnesota, but they're substantially above the national average for private, nonprofit colleges. Our colleges provide opportunities for students from all economic backgrounds. One out of four of our students are from families with incomes below $50,000. Another measure of access is the share of students who come from families that do not have a strong college attendance history. About one out of five of our students are first-generation scholars, meaning that the highest education their parents completed was a high school degree. The key to keeping our colleges accessible is financial aid. 92% of students receive grants and scholarships that don't have to be paid back. $340 million of financial aid is awarded in private grants and scholarships by our institutions. That's about 10 times the amount of state grant aid received by our students. So private philanthropy is critical to the success of our colleges. Thousands of Minnesotans, alumni and others, invest in our schools and students every year. And the result of that is that the average net tuition at our schools, the amount that students and their families actually pay, is about 51% of the published price. This chart shows in greater detail information on the economic distribution of students' families at our institutions compared to students at the two public sector systems. As you can see, our students come from more or less the same economic backgrounds as students at the two public systems.
Excuse me, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. The question I had kind of relates to what you just said there, relating back to the previous slide on page 6 where you talked about 64% of your students graduate within 4 years. Obviously, that's a very high percentage. As I recall, that's significantly higher than some of the other presentations we've been hearing. Have you guys looked at and tried to identify, you know, what maybe the top one or two reasons why that is, in terms of why that's so high? What are you doing differently than some of our public institutions, I guess, is what I'm trying to identify.
Mr. Serfenick.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, I think it would be better if I let some of our presidents take a crack at answering that question. Jay or Bob?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And sir, if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Jay Barnes, President of Bethel University. Arden Hills, Minnesota. Thank you. I think the top factor I would put would be the focus on personal attention for the students going through our programs. We are concerned not only with top quality scholarship and research done by our faculty, but we hire faculty with students in mind, looking for people who have a deep commitment to classroom teaching, mentoring our students, and value spending time with students and helping them be successful as a key factor in our hiring process. Also on our campuses, we have academic support areas. We have what we call our Academic Enrichment and Support Center, which provides tutoring and academic support for any course offered during the first 2 years of college. We think those are among the factors that help success in our graduation rates.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you. How would you answer somebody that would say, well, you just don't admit the kids that are going to fail. You just admit the kids that can achieve that degree in 4 years. What would your response be to that?
Bob? I'm Robert Holst, President of Concordia University, St. Paul.
Mr. Holst.
25% of our students come from families earning less than $30,000. 40% of our students of color come from families earning less than $30,000. And we are the most diverse private college in the state of Minnesota. Maybe next year will be Augsburg, I don't know. But in the heart of the city, our mantra is access to opportunity for excellence in education and vocation. We admit students that we take a chance on. We don't brag about students that we don't accept, 1 out of 10. We brag about students we give a chance. But it takes a lot of mentoring, a lot of caring. I can give you a lot of personal stories about students that, well, I'll just mention one, Tootie Martin. Grew up in a family of five, three brothers, two brothers, a sister. Parents never married. None of them had the same father and mother. They either had the same father, different mother. In high school, he wasn't serious. His counselors told him, you should think about janitorial work. But his football coach said, you guys all need to go to college. He didn't know how to apply. Concordia happened to be recruiting a buddy, so he came in. We had makeup math. We had makeup English. He graduated in 4 years, was on the student council. In the meantime, two of his brothers went to prison, and his sister had a baby out of wedlock. And to me, we've got stories all over like that. It takes hands-on care, and it takes professors who identify in the classroom, and through coaches, through mentoring programs, students that need that hand. There is a commitment. And, you know, to me, you don't need an SAT or ACT score. Show me the income tax, and I'll show you where they are, because it's locked in. It's locked in.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Madam Chair, David Anderson, President of St. Olaf College, my alma mater, and that of your distinguished colleague, Senator Sexauer. And both of my colleagues are right. I'll give a couple of quick examples from St. Olaf. Our Dean of Students Office meets every week, and they sit around a table and they say, who are the students that we're worried about this week? And that's something you can only do when you're working at a certain critical mass of support versus students that you have. We have something called a continuous reporting system. If a student isn't in class, isn't doing well, looks uncomfortable, looks unhappy, professor fills up that form, sends it in, boom, that student is called upon and visited, within the next week. And so it's a sort of a continuous monitoring and support system for all of our students that's available, and I think that's the key to success, along with what President Post was describing.
Mr. Sirk Bennings, whenever you're ready. I don't know what you're trying to catch.
Madam Chair, the next slide gives you some information on access to our colleges by students of color. The orange line on this chart shows the growth over the last decade in the ethnic and racial diversity of our incoming students. In this current academic year, about 18% of new freshmen and incoming transfer students are students of color. Our schools provide broad and enriching learning opportunities outside the normal classroom experiences. When we survey our alums, about 9 out of 10 say they gained valuable real-world experience while in college through internships, undergraduate research projects, service learning programs, and study abroad opportunities. These kinds of experiential learning opportunities are an important part of the value in an education at our schools. 2 weeks from today, on Monday, February 28th, we will hold our annual Private College Scholars at the Capitol program, where you will have an opportunity to see firsthand examples of undergraduate research projects at our schools. We'll have 37 undergraduates here in the rotunda with poster boards that summarize their research. They will be eager to talk with legislators and staff and visitors about their research projects, and some of them will be accompanied by faculty they worked with on these projects. The disciplines represented will be diverse, including biology and English, computer science, American Indian Studies, and nursing. There's a brochure in your packets with some information about this event, and we've also mailed all legislators materials about the event as well. So we look forward to seeing you there if your schedule permits. Another of the hallmarks of our colleges is the many study abroad opportunities that they offer, which allow more than 4,000 students to study abroad each year. In fact, 7 of our colleges are ranked nationally for the share of students studying abroad, and our schools are the source of about 60% of all Minnesota undergrads who study abroad. In today's global economy, the experiential learning gained through study abroad is crucial to the future economic success for our state and nation. Our schools have a significant economic impact on Minnesota. First, we make a critical contribution to the future workforce. 76% of our recent grads are staying here, working, and contributing to our economy. A second way to think about our contribution is to look at how many of our students continue their educations. About 1/4 of our alums pursue graduate-level education. We are an important source of graduate students for the University of Minnesota. Our undergrads represent about 1 out of 8 graduate students at the University of Minnesota. And when you look at national data and consider all the undergrads who earn their bachelor's degree in Minnesota and then went on to earn doctorate degrees, about 1/2 of those students earn their bachelor degrees from one of our institutions. Finally, our colleges and universities are significant business entities in our state. Collectively, our institutions put about $1.2 billion into the Minnesota economy each year through our operating and capital spending. And our employee count, when combined together, would make the private nonprofit colleges the state's 11th largest employer. So in summary, our colleges offer Minnesota students academic excellence. They have an enrollment that reflects Minnesota, they link students with the world, and they produce graduates with broad knowledge, critical thinking skills, and lifelong learning ability, the essential tools for economic success in today's economy. That's a summary of all 17 of our schools. I'd like to just ask the presidents each to talk for a few minutes about their particular schools, and we're happy to answer questions. When we're done, then, if we could take a few minutes to talk briefly about the state grant program, we'd like to conclude with that.
Thank you very much. Dr. Barnes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a privilege to talk about Bethel University today. You're going to hear profiles of 3 schools that have significant similarities and significant differences. And I think the selection of the 3 of us gives you something of the breadth of the schools within the Minnesota Private College Group. Bethel University was founded in 1871 in the city of Chicago, actually literally in the midst of the Great Chicago Fire. It was part of what eventually became the University of Chicago, but had great wisdom in moving north in the early 1900s. That wisdom was betrayed slightly when we spent 2 years in Nebraska before coming back home to St. Paul, where we have been ever since. Some of you would recognize our earlier campus right across from the state fairgrounds in what is now the Humphrey Job Corps Center. Frankly, I can't quite imagine starting school while the state fair was going on, but no doubt ingenious students found ways to park cars, collect the revenue, and then depart during those early days in the St. Paul campus. Our mission of being boldly informed and motivated by the Christian faith has been with us from the beginning. Although we started as a seminary preparing pastors for leadership in what was then an immigrant denomination, the Swedish Baptist Conference, we quickly broadened to be more inclusive in terms of both the denomination served and the variety of majors offered. Bethel University today, in the last year, educated more than 6,400 students. The College of Arts and Sciences drives about 80% of our budget, with over 2,900 students in that part of the university in enrollment last year. Our College of Adult and Professional Studies has been around for more than 20 years, helping working adults complete degrees that they may have started and never finished. We had over 800 students in that part of Bethel last year. our graduate school, also about 20 years old, educated about 1,300 students last year. And our seminary, which is the 10th largest seminary in North America, with teaching sites in St. Paul, San Diego, somebody had a good idea there, or teaching sites in the Northeast, educates about 1,200 students a year. Like the other colleges in Minnesota, at least on average, our students hail largely from Minnesota. 91% of our fall new freshmen and transfers applied for financial aid. As the slide indicates, 88% demonstrated need. We have a slightly higher socioeconomic profile than Dr. Holt's school, but still the number of students for us under incomes of $50,000 is a significant portion of our student body. We also get a number of transfers from community colleges in the College of Arts and Sciences, and transfers from community colleges make up about half of our population in our College of Adult and Professional Studies. Our top majors in the College of Arts and Sciences are business and marketing, education, and health professions, especially nursing, which has been a tremendous growth area for us. And if you want to get sick and be in the hospital, I think you should look for a Bethel nurse, since we are consistently among the top nursing programs in the state in terms of pass rates on the nursing licensure exams. We have nationally recognized programs in physics and art. And in the College of Adult and Professional Studies and Graduate School, we focus primarily on business-related programs, including an MBA program, as well as master's programs in nursing and counseling psychology. Bethel has developed over the years a number of significant partnerships. One of our most important is with the Frogtown Summit University Community Partnership, which has been going for over 13 years. We offer special programs, tuition assistance for our Adult and Professional Studies area, as well as our traditional undergraduate area, the residents of Frogtown. We also run degree completion programs in Frogtown, and we help students spend a semester studying and serving in that area. In fact, we have a full-time staff member in the Frogtown neighborhood helping to connect coursework in our traditional undergraduate program with agencies in that area. We also have a longtime partnership with the Union Gospel Mission that helps us both with the King Family Foundation Child Development Center, which Bethel runs in a building owned by the Union Gospel Mission, and also a summer and school year program called SOAR, Students on a Roll, where Bethel students connect with students from Frogtown neighborhoods. King Family Foundation Child Development Center is an award-winning preschool located in the Ober Center on Western Avenue. It's been recognized nationally by the National Association of Education of Young Children, awarding national accreditation as a four-star parent aware rating. It's also been partnering with the St. Paul Public Schools in terms of early reading readiness, and the graduates of our program there have great success, being several grade levels ahead of their peer group when they go into the public schools. And these are primarily children of color from very low-income families that are educated in that situation. Bethel, as well as Concordia, are part of the Twin Cities Collaborative, sponsored by the Bush Foundation, to prepare the next 25,000 needed public educators. We are thankful to be part of that initiative to transform teacher preparation in Minnesota and the Dakotas. We're preparing well-qualified teachers, and that's been part of our mission from the early decades of Bethel's existence as a four-year college, which only goes back to 1947. You've heard statistics already about the importance of study away programs for the Minnesota private colleges. I think it has nothing to do with our winter weather, but an amazing number of them seem to study in warm weather sites. We rank 15th nationally in the percentage of students studying abroad. Like several others at this table, we had students in Egypt, firsthand glimpse of what change in government looks like in countries other than our own. We have partnerships with other universities in Kenya, Uganda, South Africa, and more than 150 locations where our students can study abroad. We also are participants in the Veterans Affairs Yellow Ribbon Program, which helps reach out to veterans coming back to study. Financial aid has been a key factor for us. This slide tells you the number of financial aid appeals that have happened in the last 3 years, which for us is a measure of how the big numbers about the economy affect our own students at Bethel University. By our count, approximately 475 families with students at Bethel last year, somebody in that family lost a job. When that happens, we have to make an institutional decision about how we step up and partner with those families during a time of significant crisis and need. So for us, our financial aid budget has increased 30% over the last 2 years to try to help students and their families get through this very challenging economic time. And for us, the state grant program is vital in that. It helps our most needy students provide an opportunity to go to schools like Bethel. State grant, federal Pell grants, and other associated grants are about equal in terms of our overall financial aid budget. Overall, Bethel kicks in about $22 million a year. State and federal portions are about $4 million each. But we find, again, significant issues in trying to make sure that our families get the type of help they need to make Bethel and other private colleges affordable. When I think of our placement rates and our success in getting people into the workplace, I think of a number of people who've gone out from Bethel who are successful. Colin Barr, one of our graduates, is president of Ryan Companies for Minnesota. He's not only one of our good board members, but he's a Bethel dad as well as a Bethel grad. Last week, I had the chance to talk with Stephanie Smith, who's getting international recognition for her work with Native Americans and working with the Fort Snelling site and other factors that are very important to our place and culture. Today in Afghanistan, we not only have troops on the ground serving in a variety of fields, but we have a young woman named Toop on the ground. Katie is one of our graduates from physics who for the last 4 years has been working with 10 Afghanistan villages in places that nobody in their right mind would go, but helped to provide clean water and sanitary facilities for them as a way of bringing her faith to life in that particular setting. This morning at 6:30, Bethel University students were at Sheridan School in Northeast Minneapolis, helping the children in that school pack meals for Haiti. And that's just one of the fun things that we think about when we think about Bethel graduates going out into the world to make a difference. That gives you a snapshot, a little bit about what we're about. We're thankful for the opportunity to present a picture of one of the important private universities in Minnesota in great partnership with 16 others in the Minnesota Private College Council, and in partnership with the University of Minnesota system and the MinSCU system, and providing an educated workplace for the future. Thank you for the chance to describe Bethel University to you.
And thank you, Dr. Barnes. I'd like to add one more successful graduate. You have a young lady named Emily Boyer, who is now the assistant to the president of the Minnesota State Senate. So
we're very thankful for Katie's role there, and she had a chance to say hello before we started today.
She actually mentioned that you had handed her her diploma. So
I did, and I was proud to do it.
So thank you very much. I appreciate it. Any questions from the committee? Yes, then we will move on. And I believe Dr. Anderson, I'm looking at the slides, right? Dr. Anderson, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for this opportunity briefly to describe who we are and what we do at St. Olaf. We're one of the nation's leading four-year residential colleges. 98% of our students live on campus. We only offer undergraduate degrees. And our goal is to offer an academically rigorous education couched in a vibrant faith tradition. We've been affiliated with the Lutheran Church since our founding 137 years ago in 1874. We're a liberal arts college. Here's what that means to us. The defining characteristic of the world that our students will inhabit when they are my age will be change. When I was a first-year student at St. Olaf 41 years ago, a computer took up the size of a good room in a house. The cell phone in my pocket has more computing power than those computers. Each one of you can think of 50 examples from your own lives of how the world has changed since you were in college. It seems to us, therefore, that it's short-sighted on our part, bad investment on our students' part, for us to prepare them for the world exactly as they find it today, so we don't. We try instead to prepare them to flourish in whatever unknown world they will encounter when they're my age. How do we do that? Basically, three things. One, a knowledge base, because you do have to know something. You can't learn everything there is to know in college. There's too much to know. But you can learn what the fundamental divisions, what the geography of human knowledge is, You can understand that there are certain kinds of methods that work better to answer some kinds of questions than others. You learn those methods. You learn how to locate a problem in the geography of human knowledge and how to solve it. So knowledge base, analytical thinking, the ability to communicate clearly and correctly, to work in groups, and all of this with attention and careful thought to the consequences of your actions. That's what a liberal arts education is as we provide it. Here's what it isn't. An education that produces a bunch of unfocused and unprepared young people who go and live in their parents' basements and become a drain on the body politic. We graduate 83% of our students in 4 years. In 6 years, it's an even higher number. When they graduate, 55% of our students get a job. 31% go to graduate school or professional school and pursue an advanced degree of one kind or another. 14% volunteer with organizations such as Teach for America, AmeriCorps, Lutheran Volunteer Corps, and the Peace Corps. Particular strengths of the institution are we're well known for what I'm going to boldly call world-class programs in music and in mathematics. We have, for many years, been the baccalaureate antecedent of more people who are into PhD in math and statistics than any other liberal arts college in America. We consistently rank in the top 10 among baccalaureate colleges in America in the number of our graduates who go on to earn doctoral degrees in chemistry, physical sciences, life sciences, and engineering. 40% of our students currently are pursuing a major or a concentration in the natural sciences and mathematics. 5% of our graduating class goes to medical school on average every year. We sent more students to study abroad last year and the year before than any other liberal arts college in America. So an important part of the experience offered at St. Olaf is an awareness of your place in a global economy, in a global geography, and a global environment. We're very concerned as a liberal arts institution about the outcomes that our students experience. And so I want to describe for you just very briefly the number one initiative on my mind. It's called the Main Street Initiative. And it's simply a very focused series of efforts on the part of the college to make sure that every student during his or her time at the college is directed and supported to have a thoughtful and intentional conversation with himself or herself about what your gifts are, what your talents are, how you can best use them for the good of the world, and how that translates into financial independence and personal and professional fulfillment. So we are very focused on harnessing the power of our alumni base, which is 30,000 people, 13,000 of them in the Twin Cities metro area, to help these students figure out who they are, figure out what they're good at, and figure out what they should be. And I would ask Paul, if you would, to go to the third slide. I think the best way to help the committee see the impact of a college like St. Olaf on the state in which we're happy to dwell is the results of the education that our students experience. So we put some names up. What do our students do? Well, here are three of them who are in government. Your distinguished colleague, also Senator Marty, and the representative from the 3rd District, in the U.S. House of Representatives, Supreme Court Justice, former governor, and leaders in Medtronic, Mayo, Wells Fargo, Regents Hospital, the Anderson Corporation, Target. You can read them for yourself. And the next slide indicates the number of St. Olaf graduates currently employed in the following leading Minnesota companies. The students who come to us from all walks of life. 84% of our students are receiving financial aid. That financial aid is either government provided, federal government aid, state aid, or St. Olaf gift aid. It's usually a combination of all three. We're going to talk in a minute about the state grant program, but I'll just tell you very quickly that it represents about $1.5 million worth of aid to our students. This year, at the moment, we expect about 440 of our students to be recipients of state aid. The average family income of a student who gets state grant at St. Olaf is $53,600. It is not an inexpensive proposition to receive an education at our college or any of the other private colleges. The average indebtedness for the graduates in the class of 2010 was $26,115. So thank you for this opportunity briefly to describe who we are and what we do, and I welcome an opportunity later to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Senator Tomassoni. And might I just say we're thrilled to have Senator Tomassoni back.
Well, it's a thrill to be back. Just so you know, I could be sitting in my living room today, but I thought it was just as easy to sit in this chair. Dr. Anderson, is that list of distinguished graduates, is that by age or is it by importance or what?
I respectfully decline to answer that question, sir.
It is always risky to put that in writing.
I don't know. I have no idea what he's doing.
And once again, like I said, we're thrilled to have you back. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Anderson, I was just curious what your total enrollment was. I don't remember.
Enrollment is 3,100, sir.
Thank you.
Yes.
He's not on that list?
No.
Anything else, members? So then we are moving. I'm sorry. Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I was just wondering if you could explain a little bit about the partnerships you have with some of the urban schools that brings more students into your campus. I know there's some with the St. Paul schools. I don't know if there's more. Maybe you could explain that a little bit.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Dr. Anderson.
Thank you. We have an education department at the college that has chosen to focus its curriculum and teacher preparation on public schools in diverse areas that face many challenges. And our students do their student teaching and experience public education along the way in various schools in St. Paul, particularly Humboldt School. And so we have a large presence in the in schools in St. Paul neighborhoods, and we are hosts to all of the federal TRIO programs. This is a federally funded program that encounters students in middle school, encourages them to consider college attendance, supports them during college attendance, and then encourages and supports their attendance in graduate school. And these are our TRIO programs, as they're called, also have a focus in the same area.
Thank you very much. Anything else, members? And we'll move on to Dr. Holst.
Chair, for the opportunity to be here, and to all of you. I can be somewhat briefer, I think, because in many ways we are similar to the other two that have spoken, although we are significantly different in our location. We are, together with Augsburg, probably the most inner-city urban of the 17 campuses. And this year, I believe our statistics, we are the most ethnically diverse. About 40% of our student body represents minority students, so-called. As I mentioned before, 25% of our students come from families earning $30,000 or less, and 40% of our students of color come from earning families of $30,000 or less. This gives us a tremendous responsibility to make sure that these students get a good education and they do graduate. One of the things that we work at hard is service learning, because we know that students learn from the experiences that they have. So they're involved in a variety of ways as they study, and have a variety of experiences working with homeless, with women's shelters, and other areas as far as schools. Some of the things that I might mention is we think we're the only school in the United States that has a Center for Hmong Studies. Li Pao Zhang leads that. We've had three international conferences that have brought scholars from around the world there, and we've had two international Fulbright scholars that have studied and taught there. We are a Southeast Asian teacher school. The superintendents from St. Paul and Minneapolis came to us a number of years ago when 3% of the teachers were Hmong. but 30% of the students were Hmong, and they asked us to help educate student teacher aides so that they could get their certificate and become registered teachers. That program has been so successful that other ethnic groups have appealed that they would be admitted, so probably now it's about half Southeast Asian teacher aides, but also Somali, Sudanese, and other groups. We've had great history and tradition with educating African-American teachers. At one time, Concordia St. Paul was recognized as having educated more African-American teachers for the state of Minnesota than any school, including the University of Minnesota. I don't think that's true anymore, but we still that's one of our blessings. But 80% of our students come from between Rochester and St. Cloud. We have roughly not quite 3,000 students, 2,810, but that may vary today because we do a lot of online and cohort. We have about 1,200 students that are graduate students, about 600 that are degree completion, and about 1,200 that are in the traditional bachelor's program. Because of the demographic makeup of our student body, we have tried to become transfer friendly. We are very conscious of the debt that students could graduate with, so we encourage them to think about going to a community college for 1 or 2 years, and so we've worked very hard to become transfer friendly with articulation agreements with some of the community colleges, and we're very fortunate in the state of Minnesota to have some very fine community colleges. Just to maybe close with something that I'm proud of, and I think we work very hard to be part of our community. We have a book of the year every year, and a number of years ago it was Tom Brokaw's. And our history department works very hard at oral history and involving students in oral history. And that year, when we had the book of the year, The Greatest Generation, Thomas Saylor taught students how to do oral history, which resulted in the Minnesota History Society doing Remembering the Good War, The Greatest Generation Minnesota Experiences. During Dr. Saylor's research and the students' research, they found some horrendous stories of prisoners of war Minnesota, and that resulted in a second book, The Long Hard Road, American POWs During World War II. Both of these books, although written in the end by Dr. Saylor, involved significant students learning how to do oral history and much about their own. The other book that's received national recognition really recently is Paul Hilmer's People's History of the Hmong. Again, Dr. Hilmer saw Hmong students in his class. He said, I don't know anything about their background. And many of the Hmong today cannot communicate well. They don't understand the war. They don't understand who General Vang Pao was. And so he helped the students develop the ability to interview their parents and their grandparents. And again, it resulted in a book that, as I said, has received actually national recognition, and Dr. Hilmer has spoken a variety of places. So I think that exemplifies what Concordia and the other colleges are doing to try to be understanding of the community and assets in the community. And thank you for your support enabling students to study at our private colleges, where we really do take pride in our graduation rates and our hands-on care that enables students to blossom. Many of us come to our campus like a rosebud that's a bud, and when they graduate, it's amazing the opportunities that they have in graduate school and in vocation. And it's a great part because of the Minnesota grant, too. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all for coming today. 60,000 students that the council's members have. That's expanded, has it not, over the last 10 or 15 years considerably? And what do you see as the future generally as you as a group of colleges in terms of expansion?
Dr. Barnes.
I'm not sure anyone can speak for all of us, but we look at a number of factors in considering our future. First, we look at the demographics in the state of Minnesota and the upper Midwest, and we see over the next roughly decade a downward trend in the number of high school graduates. So that, of course, has our attention. For those that recruit more nationally, like St. Olaf would, maybe that's less of a challenge than for those of us who recruit primarily in the upper Midwest. For us, it's meant growing our graduate and degree completion programs, recognizing the need for an educated workforce as being one of the keys to our economic future, we're very concerned about reaching out into companies where you have good people who have kind of topped out in terms of their educational level. So if there's a growth area for us at Bethel, and I would suspect at Concordia, it's more likely to be in our graduate and degree completion programs than in our traditional undergrad. I feel like if I can kind of hold steady at 2,900 students in our traditional market, I'll be doing well.
Dr. Anderson, you wanted to add to that?
Madam Chair, I would just observe that I think one of the great strengths of the American higher education generally, and higher education in Minnesota in particular, is the opportunity for students to have multiple points of access to that experience. And I think probably the most important thing for the overall long-term benefit of the state is to retain multiple points of access. Some students are going to need and want one kind of education at a particular kind of institution at a particular time in their lives, and others another. And anything I think that restricts those various opportunities and restricts choice is probably unlikely to be helpful in the long run. In our own view, we don't anticipate growth. We think the capital investment that we would have to make to grow to 5,000 and 7,000 simply couldn't be supported by the additional revenue that we generate. And so our decision at the moment is to remain focused on the thing that we do and attempt to do it in such a fashion that there will always be a demand for it.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. You know, one of the as this number of students, potential students for enrollment goes down and our need for graduates goes up, one of the places that we might look where we could invest, where investment already has been made in those students that have started in education, have completed a number of credits, and then drop out for one reason or another. They have to work or they have families that they need to support. Are there competitive problems between your private colleges, between each one another, much less between public and private, that would stop us from collecting in a central place all the names of students and their ages and the number of credits they've completed as a bank of persons that we might find a way of connecting with and helping them thinking about coming back and completing their education?
I don't think there would be a problem with it. I think that we would appreciate something like that. One of the mantras that we have in Minnesota private, we cooperate because we compete. And we know that we're in competition for students, although you can see our three universities are very different in location. Many students are uncomfortable coming into the city, and many city students are uncomfortable going to Northfield. And so I think, but what you talk about, the degree completion program, that we think is an important part of service to the community, service for families, and these bring in mature, responsible students. They're not worried about peer pressure in high school. They have families, they have jobs that they've been successful in. They're coming out of the military. We're also a Yellow Ribbon University. And they if there's any problem, they try too hard. They want nothing but A's, and they will sacrifice. So I think any support that we could get in identifying those students, we at Concordia welcome, and I would suspect everybody would. Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Just to follow up, so there isn't anything about privacy or that you would there have to be a process where they have to be a release signed that the for any student that doesn't complete a degree, their name would go into a statewide bank that at some time in the future any university, public or private, would, or if we had a system in which we would try to connect with them and say, what are your reasons and can we bring you back in at some future date, that there'd be a problem in accomplishing something like that?
Dr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that question, but our registrar does, and we could find it for you easily.
Dr. Barnes.
Madam Chair, when I think of students who have not completed a degree, they fall into two different camps. There are those 20-year-olds who drop out still trying to find themselves and are ready to come back in 2 years. The other group, which I think is the more significant group, that group's likely to find its way back without a lot of help on its own. The group that I think needs more encouragement because they've been out of school for a decade or more is the group of adult learners who are mid-30s to mid-40s, people who are already in the workforce, the type of people, that person that Dr. Holse was describing. These people take a lot of courage to get back into school. They often need financial help, significant financial help to do it. They're trying to balance a full-time job, a family, and everything else in addition to school. If an 18-year-old thinks he gets his money worth by maximizing the number of class cuts, in contrast, the 47-year-old will take your head off if you cancel class, even if there are 2 feet of snow on the ground. It's just a different level of motivation. One of the problems nationally right now is with the rulemaking of the Department of Education in Washington and trying to standardize how we define credit hours based on a mindset about 18-year-olds not recognizing the learning experience of the 47-year-old and all the richness that that person brings to the classroom. So we're very concerned about reaching those people in midlife and providing at least some of our schools the type of education that's appropriate for them, that maximizes the learning experiences that they've had in the workplace, the maturity that they've had, and the ideas that they bring to the table, being guided by an adult learner facilitator who's not the sage on the stage, but more the guide on the side.
Any other questions? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and forever, whoever you think would best answer this question. You shared with us earlier, I think, relating to my first question, is that you related a lot of your graduation success to your faculty. Can you give us a sense for, you know, the average wage of your faculty compared to the average wage of faculty at the University of Minnesota and what some of those differences might be? Is it because of research work or is it because of length of service or that type of thing? Is anybody willing to comment on that at all a little bit?
Dr. Anderson.
Chair, I don't have good information about what starting and ending salaries are in the university system, but I can tell you what ours are. If you're a brand new PhD or other terminal degree person, just finished graduate school and probably starting your first teaching job at St. Olaf, I think the range of your starting salary is going to be in the mid-50,000s. And after you've taught there for if you stay and teach there your whole career, it will be closer, it will effectively probably have doubled.
Dr. Barnes.
Ours would be lower than that. We benchmark against the other Minnesota private colleges and universities with our faculty salaries. We're trying to be at the midpoint, excluding Carleton and McAllister, because they're outliers for us. My impression of the University of Minnesota system is that it's a system that has better pay for faculty than at least my school does. I feel like the people who come to work at Bethel are not only exceptionally qualified in terms of their degree status, but in terms of their vision for the mission of the university that I related to earlier in terms of teaching, mentoring students, and so forth. They don't get paid what they're worth would be my bottom line. We would range from the high 40s to the upper 90s probably.
Dr. Holst.
That would be similar to ours. I think what I tell benefactors is we will overwork and underpay our faculty and staff. In return, if they are motivated by short hours and pay, they're soon gone. So we get the kind of dedication from our faculty and staff that I think leads to the kind of success that our students experience. They know they could get paid more someplace else.
Senator Peterson.
Do you have, to follow up, thank you, Madam Chair, do you have a sense for, you know, that entry-level PhD? How many classes do they teach usually?
Dr. Barnes,
so I see seven.
Seven is our standard for all faculty.
And then do you have a Madam Chair, do you have a sense for how many they're teaching towards the end of their career?
It's the same.
Thank you.
Dr. Holst.
I think one of the things that we pride in, too, that we will have full professors teaching the 101 classes. Because if you're going to have a strong English program, the new professor may be excellent, but may not be the most excellent. And so we take pride in it's not just the junior faculty that teach the 101 science or the 101 math, but that senior professors are involved at that level, too. It helps them keep aware of the changing attitudes in high schools, too. It's learning in high schools is different from school to school. And so our senior professors who are going to be dealing with the majors at that level need to be aware of where they're coming in at, too. So I think that's one of the differences that we offer. Our senior professors will also be involved in those introductory classes.
And Dr. Barnes, is it 7 a year, 7 per semester?
7 per year.
Okay.
We have a 3-1-3 calendar, so 3 courses in the fall, 1 in January, 3 in spring.
Thank you.
So it would be 24 credits would be a typical faculty load for the year.
Thank you. Senator Sharon.
Thank you. I guess I didn't hear you talk about research within your institutions and whether or not, as a part of the description of the pie of how time is distributed for your faculty, what obligations they have for writing books or doing research. Could you speak to that?
Dr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Typical faculty portfolio at any institution of higher education will fall into 3 areas. One is teaching, the other one is research, and the third one is lumped under service, which can mean anything from playing a role on campus governance to being the president of the Society of Astrophysics. At our institution, and I'm quite sure that what I'm about to say is true for these others, there's no lack of clarity about this fact. Your fundamental role is to be a teacher of our students. And there is never a time when it is more important for you to be doing research than to be engaged in that activity. Nevertheless, we take the view that if you're not engaged in professional inquiry that results in you putting the results of your work before your colleagues in the discipline for their evaluation, then we're concerned about its ongoing validity and freshness and accuracy. So there is an expectation for research activity, but you do not have to publish a book to gain tenure at St. Olaf College. However, if you haven't engage in any research activity during the probationary period, put nothing in front of your colleagues for peer review, then you would not get tenure at St. Olaf College.
Dr. Holst.
I would say the same. The goal is to teachers. One of the opportunities that we have, especially in summer school with science, there have been a number of partnerships because the new students, minority students, especially female students, do not think in the area of science. So we have a summer research project in science that our professors work with high school students, helping them understand the joy of research. And that has been very influential in helping some of these students then go on to college where they might not have thought about it before. So it's not only during the year, but there are opportunities to work with other organizations for research at other times. But the goal for Concordia, again, would be their number one love would be teaching, but to be a teacher, you have to be an expert in your field, and that expertise is always growing.
Mr. Cirkbenig, I think you wanted to finish up with the state grants issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we could take just a few minutes to talk about the state grant program. I think a good starting point for talking about the state grant program is this chart, which shows on a state-by-state basis the relationship between the percentage of a state's population with a four-year degree and per capita income for each state. As you can see, there are low education states and high education states. High education states are states above the orange line, which is the national average. You can also see that there are high income and low income states. High-income states are those to the right of the orange line, which is the national average. Thankfully, Minnesota is a high education and high-income state. But the key thing to observe about this graph is that, for the most part, There are high education, high income states, and low education, low income states. With the exception of a couple borderline states, there are no low education states that are high income states. What this graph shows is that a critical key to economic prosperity is to have a highly educated citizenry. To succeed economically in the coming years, we are going to have to increase the share of our population that earns some kind of post-secondary degree. Now, increasing that share of citizens who have a post-secondary degree is not going to be an easy challenge to meet. This chart shows the performance, the college completion performance of high-ability eighth graders. It documents what we probably all know just by common sense and personal experience. Students from high-income families and middle-income families have significantly higher success rates in completing college than do students from low-income families. And this is true even of high-ability students from low-income families. Our challenge is compounded by the fact that in the next 10 years, the share of low-income students is going to increase in our population. This chart is the percentage of students qualifying for free and reduced lunch in Minnesota. And you can see for 10th graders, about 30% qualify. But when you go all the way down to today's first graders, about 40% qualify. So we are going to have more students coming through our educational system that start out in that low-income family group. The students who are known to have the hardest challenges to succeeding in completing a college degree. That's why the state grant program is so critical. It targets scarce public resources to those students who face the highest challenge to college success. Now, there are many challenges for those students, but one very significant one is the economic challenge. The state grant program is going to be a key way Minnesota can help, but the way the legislature can help Minnesota maintain its status as a high education, high state. Now, I'm going to just touch on this quickly. I think many of you are familiar with the state grant program, but I want to say and remind you all that it's a program that serves public institution students and private institution students. And both in terms of the number of recipients and in terms of the distribution of the dollars, the majority of those dollars and the majority of the recipients are students attending public institutions in Minnesota. It distributes aid based on need, and it allows students to find the type of institution that they feel best will meet their educational needs. For the last biennium, the state appropriated about $290 million for the state grant program, about $145 million a year. Because the recession caused increased enrollments and increased financial need, in the second year of the biennium, there was a $35 million shortfall in funding for the state grant program. That shortfall required a rationing of state grants. About 18,000 students lost their grants entirely, and another 85,000 students had grants reduced from between $250 and $1,800. And that was just in the last year. If you look at a longer time period, you'll see that the impact of the state grant program has been slipping for some time. I'm going to give you two charts that show this. This first chart shows the percentage of tuition and fees that the state grant, that the average state grant covers for a student by sector. So the red line is the University of Minnesota students, the yellow line is students at the Minsky system, and the blue line is students at the Minnesota Private College Council schools. And you can see at all three schools, or at all three sectors, over time, the grant is covering a smaller portion of the student's tuition and fees. Another way to look at it is just to look at the average grant per recipient. It was at a high in 2006-2007 academic year of $1,947, and it's been declining each year. The figure for 2010-2011 is an estimate. We don't have complete data yet from the Office of Higher Education, but we know that that number is declining because students lost grants, and every student who got to keep a grant had their grant reduced. So we want you to be aware that the state grant program is important to our economic challenge and that the impact it's having is slipping.
Senator Sharon.
Before you, are you going on?
I'm going to say one more thing, but I'll
just on the last graph that where you're showing the different the university, MinSCU, and that is a percent of the tuition that you've listed.
That's
in
right.
Here.
The so, published tuition fees.
So if the tuition is lower, the percent is going to be higher.
That's than, right. Yeah. The point isn't how much it's replacing, but that for every student, it's replacing a smaller share of tuition today than it was 10 years ago. We get a lot of questions about debt. We got questions when we testified in the House committee a couple weeks ago. And so we want to give you a little information about student debt. It relates, of course, to the grant program because one thing the grant program does is help students manage and have a reasonable amount of borrowing. This is data from the 2007-08 academic year. It's my understanding that that's the most recent year for which this kind of information is available. And so this is the debt for graduating students by sector. For students at our schools, the average debt is $28,600. For Minnesota's public institutions, now this is the University of Minnesota system and the MinSCU four-year system combined, $23,600. And for private for-profit schools that are 2 years or more in programming, their average student debt is $40,600. And then just one more question. You hear, we all hear about very large amounts of student debt. And what we want you to know is that at least where we have data for our schools and for the public schools, those are real outlier experiences. 90% of all students who graduate from our schools have debt of less than $40,000, and 90% of graduates at Minnesota's two public sector institutions have debt of less than $30,000. So for most students, debt is being managed. It's very significant. Borrowing is increasing and has been increasing for some time, and the state grant program is one critical tool that the state has to help students get through and complete a degree without being in a position where they have either borrowed an unreasonable and unaffordable amount or where they have stopped, taken a break in their education because they were unwilling to go too far into debt. The state grant program, in summary, targets students with the greatest need. It makes investments that are important for our workforce. It allows choice for students so that students can find an institution that fits their needs the best. It has a statewide impact, and it helps students minimize borrowing and future debt burden. For all these reasons, even in the face of the difficult budget situation you have, it's our view that it would be a good investment, one that would return a high value to the state, to fully fund the need in the existing program. And that does require dollars above the $290 million in the last biennium. $290 million was not enough to meet all the need in the last biennium, and as long as enrollments stay high and need stays high, it's not going to be enough to fully fund the need in this biennium. That won't mean the program's expanding. That will just mean the need, as defined by the current program, would be met. And that's our request for the legislature.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Any closing remarks?
Madam Chair, again, we would just want to say thank you for the opportunity to have this time before the committee. And if there are further questions that committee members have at any time, we'd be happy to try and provide information that's responsive to the question.
Well, thank you very much. And thank all of you for answering. Oh, Senator Senjum, just thought of something.
Madam Chair, anybody, Do we know what this number is? Just off, I mean, what we put into this grant program?
The state grant program, yeah. I mean, currently what we put into it right now, what's the number?
For last biennium?
Madam Chair, Senator Sentrum, it's about $144 million a year.
Madam Chair, if I might just add a little perspective to that.
Sure,
the state grant program is less than 10% of all higher education funding in the state, about 9.4% in the last biennium. Nearly all of the higher education dollars are appropriated to the two public sector institutions. Only a small share of the state's higher education investment is made in this program.
Thank you. Well, we really do appreciate you coming in and answering questions and sharing a lot of great information with us, so we really appreciate it. And if there are further questions, I'm sure that members, it says on the last page there how to get a hold of Mr. Cervenek, and I'm sure he'd be happy to answer those questions if you think of them later. But thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And if there's no other business, we will adjourn the committee. We are adjourned.
Yeah, we should sign it so they have a good record.